This is an interview with Edward W. Tell at 6737 Katahdin Drive in Poland for the Youngstown State University's World War II Veterans Project by Stephen R. Ard on May the 24th, and the time is approximately 12:10 p.m. The year 1980. Okay, do you want to tell me when you were born?
Yes, I was born July 1st, 1917. I was born in Youngstown, Ohio, and I spent the major part of my life on the north side of Youngstown. I went through Parmalee school, grade school, Hayes Junior High School, graduated from Rayen High School in January of 1936. This was at the just about at the end of the Depression, and about in June of that year, I finally found myself a job at the Republic Steel Corporation. And I worked there for about a year. Pardon me. I then went to the Ohio State University, and I entered into a pre-medical course there. Actually, it was I came from a family that was unique in this respect. I had three uncles who were doctors, I had a sister who was a nurse, and this one uncle of mine had graduated from Cornell University as a mechanical engineer. He felt that the best training that any aspiring medical man could get. As I was saying, this uncle felt that the best training any aspiring physician could get was a background in engineering. So I was taking an engineering course as a pre-med course, although I had no aptitude at all for mathematics. And, well, anyway, I was in that up until I left to go to New Jersey after the draft had been inaugurated. And I was deferred because supposedly I was getting training which would equip me better to get into the Air Corps. And so for better than a year, I flew out in New Jersey, the Trenton Central Airport out there, and I acquired a private pilot's license, and I was working on a commercial license when war was declared. And then I went up to in I think it was February, I went up to Whitehall Street in New York City and joined the Air Corps. And I was stationed at Mitchell Field, Long Island, up until the time that the glider program was inaugurated. And I volunteered for that. So they made me a staff sergeant and sent me out to Antigo, Wisconsin, where I got my primary training in light airplane. We were sent from there down to Columbus, Ohio, where they had just completed a an airfield. And we got our first training in light gliders there. And after we had gotten our training in light gliders there, we went down to Stuttgart, Arkansas, where we were initiated into the CG-4A. That's a cargo glider that they used during World War II to transport troops and jeeps and field pieces. And then we shipped down to Texas. And from Texas, we took a train to Rhode Island, got a boat out of there. And on December the 21st, 1942, that we took off, and we were on the ocean for 42 days. We were on the ship called the Mariposa, which had been on the Hawaiian run. It'd been a luxury cruiser on the Hawaiian run there before the war, and we went overseas unescorted. For days we would go around in circles out in the South Pacific, or South Atlantic. And we were on the ocean for 42 days. We went down around the Cape of Good Hope and up the east coast of Africa and into the Red Sea, and we landed in Egypt. Then we followed, we were in Egypt for, I'd say 6 months or better, and we followed Rommel right across the desert. We were in Tunisia and Algiers. And then we took a boat from Algiers. Well, I'll say this, first of all, part of my outfit took part in the invasion of Sicily. At that particular time, I happened to be in Algiers on our squadron business. So really, I didn't know anything about the invasion of Sicily until I got back to my base. And, but as I say, part of my outfit did take place, or part in the invasion of Sicily. And after they had invaded Sicily, we flew up to Sicily, and we were at Ponta Olivia, a place called Ponta Olivia, and it had an airfield there. And I think we were there for probably, in Sicily, we were there for about probably 5 or 6 months. And then we were flying, of course, we were with a troop carrying outfit, 316th troop carrier. So naturally, we carried supplies. We into Italy, and there were just hops that would take us in, and we'd get back to the base within just a few hours after we had done our job. Of course, by that time, we glider pilots were also acting as co-pilots in the C-47 troop carrier plane. And finally left Sicily, took a boat down to Algiers. And from Algiers, we went to England. And I was stationed at a place called Oakham in England, which was an old British base. It also had an airfield. And in an area where you had an awful lot of entertainment. Nottingham, I remember the names of towns there, Nottingham and Leicester, and then there was, of course, we get up to London frequently, and we had no problem getting rooms up in London, because at that time your buzz bombs were coming over. And of course, at the hotels, well, they'd always put you up on the top floor. You'd hear these buzz bombs come over, and you'd hear them cut out. They'd cut out, and then their engine would come back on, cut out again, come back on, and then the third time it would cut out, you'd hear a deep silence, and all of a sudden a great big explosion. And of course, you never knew just where they were going to fall. That made it very interesting.
Did any of them land close to where you were at?
What's that?
Did they hit, any of them hit close to where
you were? Very, very close. Yeah. They were hitting all over. Now, when I say it was close, when it was within a block or so where I was, and I, of course, if you happen to be with a girl, she'd insist upon you getting into a shelter. But actually, a direct hit with one of those bombs, it would have obliterated the shelter anyways.
What kind of a size building could they knock down? How much area did they knock down?
City block.
A whole city block.
Yeah, yeah. They were really, I kid you not, to me, not only were they terrifying, but they were fascinating too. Any mind that could have thought up something like that must have been out of this world. And of course you had, of course, these, they also had their V8, I guess they called it the V8. These were the ones that really went up into the atmosphere, you know. It was like our, rockets, that was a rocket. The precursor to the rockets that they use to take our men to the moon now. But these rockets, they went up into the atmosphere, and you didn't even hear those coming. And the only time you knew that they were there was when they hit. And they were not only sending those over, but they were sending these other V8s, I believe they called them. They had a motor on them. But actually, at that time, as I recall, the members of the RAF would take off in their Spitfires, and they would actually go up and, with their wings, turn these rockets back out into the ocean, or out back toward Germany. I don't believe that they had enough fuel to get back to Germany, but actually they would turn them off their course by just with their wings.
Bumping them.
Yeah. And but of course many many of them got through, and it was really a very, very terrifying thing, and the people of England, their courage, you had to commend them. Couldn't see how any people could have lived through a period like that under such pressures, never knowing when they're going to breathe their last. But it was really something.
Did you ever hear of how much explosive those rockets or buzz bombs carried? Was there ever talk about that?
No, I didn't. I imagine, though, that there is much literature about them. Probably any world book or any of our literature could tell us that. as I say, I might have known at one time, but over the years, your memory of these things becomes sort of fuzzy. We were in England there for a while, and they were thinking of sending my group down to, in on the invasion of Normandy. So they sent us down to a place, which I don't recall the name of it, in order to be checked out in British gliders. Now their gliders were made of plywood. They called them horse gliders. And when they hit the ground, when they crashed, they were just like matchboxes. But our gliders were, of course, made of tubular aluminum, and we had fabric covering the body of the plane. And so you had more protection in our gliders than you did in the horse gliders. But anyway, we checked out in the horse gliders, and we had gotten so far along the way that actually we were on the line waiting for the takeoff to be towed into Normandy. Now this happened not once, but about three times that I can remember. We were on the line waiting to be towed off for the invasion of Normandy, and each time the mission was called off.
When you got there, what were you supposed to do?
We were supposed to land troops.
Mm-hmm. How many troops could you carry in one of these things?
As I recall, in the horse glider, it was around 30 men.
Okay, now when we are speaking of glider, we're speaking of a plane without an engine, right?
That's right.
And it could haul 30 men.
Yeah.
Okay.
See, these are towed by a transport plane. Mm-hmm. You have a long nylon rope which was attached to the glider. And not only could it carry men, but it also could carry field pieces, too.
How large were these things?
I would say that they were about the size. Have you ever seen a C-47? Mm-hmm. It would be about that size, you know. Maybe just a little shorter, not much.
Now, what was the idea of using a glider? Simply so it couldn't be heard by the enemy as you came in?
No. Probably that would they could hear you because you had a tow ship. The idea of the glider was you could get a lot of men down in a much, much shorter space than you could bring in an airplane in. That is, you would have to have an entire runway for a transport plane to get down. However, with a glider, you get down in a very, very small space. Of course, after World War II, your helicopters performed that function, and they could come right down, and that was the whole idea of them, the use of the helicopters, because you could get men right where you wanted to pinpoint them, and that was the idea behind the glider, to get a group of men down in a very, very limited space, and or a field piece or a jeep. And as I say, the horse glider couldn't get down in the space that the CGA-4A could. That is the American glider. It just was a much larger glider than the American glider. And another thing, they did eventually use the horse gliders in the invasion of Normandy, but the Germans had prepared all the open fields there. They put stakes in the ground, that is big steel girders and whatnot. And these horse gliders would come in and hit those girders and just disintegrate. And as I say, they're just like matchboxes. But anyway, we never did complete a mission in a horse glider. We went back to our base at Oakham and immediately began to prepare after the invasion of Normandy for the invasion of Holland. We were restricted to base, and of course, being restricted to base, there's only one thing to do, and that was to do play a lot of poker, a lot of crap. And there was many a man who went into battle wealthy, and there were many who went in broke. And we were restricted to field, I forget, for better than a week when we finally went on the invasion of Holland. And there were 2 days that I recall. The one day I sat and watched them go, and the second day I went. But it was a sight which I'll never forget. As far as you can could see in the north and the south direction, you could see transport planes, just towing gliders. And I mean, as far as you wanted, you could see. And they would come in threes. You would have a formation of three planes, and each one towing three gliders, or a glider. And they went out the first day, and then, as I recall, it was either the following day or the day after that that I went out, and we were to take our group into the Bridgehead Devils. That's where you get me. I forget the names of these different places overseas. But we were to take our, it was just about the time, just before the Battle of the Bulge. And we were to take our troops in on this side of a river, as I recall it was, I keep thinking of Nijmegen is the name of the place that we were supposed to go into. And it was a daylight mission. And we started in, and they had pinpointed the field that we were to drop at, off at. And going in, they hit my tow ship. And I'll never forget, the tow ship started around, and I could see an orange glow in the cockpit. And he started down, and of course I immediately hit my tow release, and we started down. And I had about 24 airborne troops. I believe it was 101st airborne we were taking in there. And for that particular mission, they had installed parachutes on the back by the tail of our ship with a release in the cockpit. And I came in pretty steep and pretty hot. And I forgot that the parachute was back there. And this
co-pilot of mine, a fellow by the name of Kenny White from Columbus, Ohio. Said, let's hit that parachute. I said, yes, Ken, let's hit that parachute. And he hit it. And honest to God, it was just as if somebody had thrown on a brake. Nose of the ship just dropped almost straight down, and we came in and landed with no problem at all. But immediately, a group of SS troops that were in a force that was across the field started lobbing in 88s, and we were pinned down for the rest of the day. Well, we had landed probably in the late afternoon, and from that time until dark, they kept lobbing in 88s. And, of course, as soon as it got dark, we got out of there and managed to find a group of British soldiers, a camp, and we stayed with them that night. And then the following morning, ours was not to stay there and fight. Our mission was not to stay and fight. Ours was to get troops in and then to get back to our base in order to get ready to take more in if they needed us. So we got a truck and started back toward Amsterdam. And of course, we came down this road, and as I said, this pocket of SS troopers, every now and then they cut off the road, and any trucks that happened to be going through at that time, why, they would catch hell. And fortunately, we had no problem getting through. They didn't decide to cut us off at that time, and we got back to Amsterdam, and then spent a day or two there waiting for transportation back to our base, and we finally were picked up and taken back to our base in England. Now that was about the all of the action that I saw during the war. But it was quite an experience actually going in on that mission. The flat was so tremendous that you could have almost walked on it. I don't know how the hell I ever missed my glider, or for that matter, any of the gliders. But all you would see would be a puff of smoke in front of you or beside you. And as I say, they got my tow ship. They were that close. And then, of course, being shot at by the Germans on the ground, that was no fun. But it was interesting. And I think that my life in the Army, I never resented it. To see as much as I could overseas. And actually, after that, after the invasion of Holland, it was just a wind-up, you might say. From there, we went over into France, and of course, we were ready to make the jump over the Rhine.
Now, by we, you mean the U.S. Army. Now,
the U.S. Army, my group. Was ready to make the invasion of Germany and the hop over the Rhine, but we were never called upon to do that. Another outfit did that, and after we had been in France for a matter of about a month or so, we went back to England, and we sent to a staging area where we were for about a week prior to catching a boat. And we caught the boat and came home. We landed at, where is Fort Patrick Henry? Something in Massachusetts, I guess. And from there, we were sent home for a short time, and then we were sent out to the coast for rehabilitation. And
what does rehabilitation mean?
Well, actually, they felt that you had been overseas and you had been subjected to all the stresses of war, so they had to get you back into fighting shape. And and so they sent me out to Los Angeles. And God, for a month out there, they just fed us the finest food and more or less allowed us to wind down. And we wined and dined by all the local people, you know. They always had some kind of a program going. Either a dance or a movie or a banquet of some kind.
Now, is this basically for airmen?
Well, that was for airmen there, but I imagine that the ground troops had much the same thing when they would be brought back to the States. I imagine they would be rehabilitated in the same way. But this particular spot that I happen to be was primarily for the Air Force.
Okay. Can you kind of tell me about how the procedure in terms of, let's say, taking off in one of these gliders? Now, you said each plane actually pulled a number of gliders.
Sometimes you would have the planes would tow up to a total of three gliders. Now, each glider was on a tow rope. And this was a nylon tow rope. The nylon tow rope was probably maybe an inch and a half in circumference, or in diameter, I should say. And it was probably about 100 feet long. And of course, when you had three different gliders on the same tow, you would have to have various length tow rope. One would be short, one would be intermediate, and one would be longer. And usually the middle one is a longer one, and you have your two, which would be out. And actually, when you were on a triple tow like that, the two outside men would naturally have to maintain their distance out. It's pretty hard to describe on a tape, but actually, say the middle man had a straight toe right behind the ship, but each of the other men would have to maintain an angle from that particular rope of, say, about 30 degrees. And I would say 45 degrees out. And the plane would start down the runway, and it had to be a long runway because he had an awful lot of weight to take with him. And his tail would come up. And of course, as he went down, your tail would come up as you gathered speed, and then he would get off the ground, and you would all more or less get off the ground together. And
usually your toe would be, or maybe up to around 1,500 feet, usually the height you'd go to. And if you were on a any kind of a mission, or any kind of a practice mission, why you would come in lower. I remember when we were in Africa, actually, there were nights we'd go up and we would come in low and land on fields that weren't even lighted. Come in on the reflection of the moon. Sometimes, I remember, we used to, when we were located in, as I said, we followed Rommel across the desert, and we were located in Tunisia, there on the, on the edge of the desert. And you had two different squadrons on the, one would be on one side of the field, and one would be on the other. There's our tent area. It would be in two different locations. And you'd have one strip right down the middle of the, one landing strip right down the middle of the field. And they would tow us up to 3,000 feet. And this was a fun thing. We'd cut loose up there, and then we'd start down, come screaming. From 3,000 feet, you'd come in, and you'd come in over that tent area at about maybe 100, 150 feet above the tent area. And actually, you create such a vacuum that you could see the sides of the tents balloon as you went over them. And then you'd chandel up and come around, and you'd hit that runway doing maybe 125, 30 miles an hour. You'd just go screaming down. It was really, I mean, if you love speed, why, that was the thing to do. We really enjoyed it.
And, how dangerous was the takeoff itself?
I didn't feel the takeoff was dangerous at all.
Never had any problems?
No. The only problem that you would have, I mean, the real danger would be in missing your field. That is, in undershooting your field. See, you had no engine. There's no way that if you misjudged your landing, you could say put on your power and pull yourself in. It was a matter of judging, making the right judgment, and coming in correctly. For instance, just to cite an example, when we were in Africa, we were checking out some British pilots in landing and in flying our CG-4As, and we were, it was at night, and we were up, we took off, and what we would usually do is you'd have two British glider pilots, you'd have a pilot and a co-pilot, and you'd stand behind them and give them instructions. And what they would do is take off and make a left-hand turn along the end of the field, and then you'd make another left-hand turn along the side of the field, and you'd come on down, and at a certain spot along the way, while you cut loose from your tow ship, and then the British pilot was supposed to lay his pattern for a landing, which would consist of another left-hand turn, and another left-hand turn, and then come in for a landing. Because the second left-hand turn, he should be in a position where he was lined up with the runway and would be able to come in. And I'll never forget this night. This pilot was sitting there, and we had cut loose from our tow ship, and he kept going and going and going, and I kept saying, you better turn, didn't turn. He said, you better turn. He didn't turn. I said, finally, get the hell out of there. I literally dragged him out and jumped into the pilot seat, and I racked it over, and I actually came around at a 45-degree angle, trying to angle my way back into the field. But actually, we ran out of air, and we crashed, I would say around maybe 25, 30 yards from the end of the runway, and they wiped out that glider. And as I recall, those gliders, that's around 50,000 pieces.
Did he panic or freeze up?
I don't know what he was thinking about. I don't know what he was thinking about to this day. But he kept holding it out, and I kept saying, you better start laying your base leg. And he kept holding out, and finally I could see that we were way, way past where he should have turned. I don't know whether he just froze at the controls or what.
How far could you actually glide in one of those? Was there a limit?
I'll tell you. It had a 3-to-1 ratio. In other words, for every 3 foot forward, you drop a foot. And you couldn't glide very far at all.
Okay, so in other words, without your toe plane,
your toe plane,
you were literally going down into a landing pattern immediately.
That's right. Okay.
When you did crash, going over, and you talked about the parachute, now what exactly did this parachute do?
Well, when you released the parachute, it ballooned out.
Behind the plane.
Behind the glider.
Which is gonna run. Oh, just let it.
Jackie, don't make any noise.
What?
Don't make any noise because this tape recorder is picking that up.
Sorry.
Okay.
Okay. The parachute ballooned out behind.
And it acted as a brake. I mean, it was a big parachute, and the air caught it, and it acted like a big brake. I think you've seen it on, have you ever watched TV and seen these ground runs they make? And at the end of the run, these parachutes open up and act as a big brake.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you supposed to use that every time you landed? Or was it just in your particular case?
In this particular case, we had never had them installed on our gliders before, mm-hmm. Those missions. But in the for the invasion, well, that's what they did, because they wanted to make sure that we got down into the space which was allotted to us.
Now, after down, then what'd you do with the plane?
Just the plane was expendable. And also, believe it or not, the pilot was expendable too. And now they did, and they could retrieve them. They had what they called a glider pickup. Now a glider pickup consisted of this. What they would do is put two poles up, and they would put the tow rope between them. That is a loop of the tow rope between the two poles. And tow plane would come buzzing in, and he'd probably be doing 150 miles an hour. And in this tow plane, there was a big reel. And there was a hook on the end of the tow plane. And he would come in with this hook, and he'd come low enough so that this hook would catch this loop of tow rope. And of course, the glider would be, glider pilot would be sitting behind his controls, and he would go from 0 miles an hour to about 110 miles an hour in just a few seconds. And when that hook caught the tow line, it would begin to pay out some tow rope, and then gradually this big drum would break, and then they'd begin pulling it in again. And of course, by this time, the glider would be in the air, and they could retrieve their gliders like that, but for the most part, they didn't.
Let's turn the tape over to side two. Let's go back to some of the training that you had. You had the light training in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Can you describe that to me? What did they teach you there?
Okay. In light training, we use these, what kind of a plane did we use? It was a single, it was a tandem type of plane. It was a Cub. You heard of the Cub airplane, practically all wing, but they had an engine. And this was at Antigo, Wisconsin. And what we would do, we'd go up with our instructor, and we'd be flying along, and all of a sudden, he would cut out the engine. And we would immediately begin to pick a field and lay a pattern on that field. And of course, we would start, we would simulate an approach and a landing, and just as we were about ready to go in, why, he'd flick on the engine again, the fuel, and the engine would catch, and we would take off again. This was what the primary glider training consisted of, and I guess we spent about a month or more up there, and each day we go up and we assimilate these landings. You never knew when he was going to cut the engine, and you never knew where he would be when he did cut it, and that was what made it a fun thing. You must remember at that time I was in my early 20s, and this type of thing was a daring thing. Then we went down to Columbus, and that was at Lockbourne Army Air Base. That was, they had just put that, completed that field, and there were no heavy aircraft there at that time. So they were using it as a secondary glider training spot for us. And there we got into the German Schweisser glider. And in the our training in the German Schweisser glider amounted to this. They would take a short tow rope and hook it up to a Jeep and hook it to the glider. And these gliders sat on the ground, and they had only one wheel. There's one single wheel in the middle of the fuselage. And we would be towed down the runway, and when the speed got enough, why, of course, course, we'd be up over, or up over the Jeep, and of course, the length of the one of those runways is pretty long. I mean, you go out to the Youngstown Airport here and take a look from one end of it to the other, and it's a long strip. So we would fly this glider above this Jeep, oh, maybe three quarters of the way down that runway, and then we'd cut loose and land at the farther end of the runway. And after we got used to doing this, then they used to tow us up into the up to around 2,000 or 3,000 feet and cut us loose. And then we would we could soar around as much as we wanted. You'd go along until your wing tip would suddenly rise, and you'd know that this was a thermal. It might be over a freshly plowed field or over a field of wheat or something. And once you your wing would tip up, while you dig that wing into the thermal and start spiraling, and you could gain height. Maybe you'd go up to 4,000 or 5,000 feet, and then you'd cut loose and you start down again until you hit another thermal, and you could do that again. And of course, and you never lost sight of your field, and you made sure that when you finally ran out of air, while you were at the field, period. But and as I say, we were there for maybe a month or more until we got used to that, and then we went down to Stuttgart, Arkansas, where we were introduced to the CG-4A, and it was huge in comparison to these single place jobs that we had been flying, and we were taken up and checked out on those, and it was quite an experience, because they had no glide angle to them at all, and once you cut loose from those, or cut loose from your tow ship, you were on your way down, and you had to make sure that you knew where the hell you were headed.
Did you have a radio on those?
No, we didn't have any radio.
How did they signal you to let you know that here's where you cut loose at?
Usually they would have they would flick their lights or something, such as that.
And then you were on your own?
Yeah. Now, I mean, you're looking for interesting things that happened while I was in the Air Force. One of the things I'm yet. We were stationed in Tunisia, and they were sending over the new gliders, and they would assemble them in Oran, and they would take us in to fly them back to the to our field. Well, on one of those trips, we went down and we picked up the glider and we were headed back to our base. Now, we flew over very rugged terrain down there because the Atlas Mountains are through North Africa there, and we would fly over them, and the thermals there, they were vicious. You would be up above your ship, to the side of your ship, that is in relation to your tow ship. You'd be all over the sky. You'd be down below them, looking up at them, or you never knew exactly where you'd be because the air currents were so violent. And we were going along, and all of a sudden, lo and behold, the tow rope came loose from the tow ship. And there we were out in the middle of no place with a long tow rope dangling from our nose and no tow ship. So I cut loose the tow rope and immediately picked the field. And they say that once you pick your field, never change your mind. And I headed in for this field, and I had a young fellow with me whose name was Giuseppe Capite. And Giuseppe was a timid fellow who always carried a bandolier of ammunition with him and 45 on his hip. He never went any place without it, away from the field. And incidentally, when he went in, he was one of those who went in on the invasion of Sicily. And the night they went in on the invasion of Sicily, they had high winds off of Sicily, blowing away from the shore, and a lot of the gliders never did make the shore. Well, Giuseppe went in with all his bandoliers and everything, and he happened to be in a glider that never got in. And I guess when he hit that water, he went down like a rock, because with all the ammunition he had, he just didn't stand a chance. But anyway, we came in on this approach to this field after we had lost our tow ship. And we came in hot, and up ahead of us there was a real high fence. And Giuseppe's sitting there, and he's my co-pilot. You're gonna hit it, you're gonna hit it, you're gonna hit it. And I pulled back on the stick, and we eased over the fence, and as we went over, I looked over at Giuseppe, and I said, we'll be at the wheel, we have nothing to worry about. And I set it down on the other side, and we were met by all these Arabs who had seen us coming down. And of course, Giuseppe with his 45 kept them at a distance. But they were very, very friendly people. And finally, a fellow who owned a farm, he was a Frenchman, he owned a beautiful farm there, came down. And he took us back to his farm. And but actually he took me back, because Giuseppe had to stay and watch the plane. And we had dinner there that night, and then they sent a tow ship out and jerked the glider out of there. But they took us back to the base in the commanding officer's own car. It was one of the few times I had a ride in a car when I was in the service. And, but it was just an aside from the... but it was really a lot. As I say, I wasn't one that fought my years in the service. I enjoyed it. I had no ties back here. I was unmarried, and as I say, I had been in school, and had spent the year before that getting just flying, and I was doing what I liked to do.
You mentioned on the way over you had no escort for your ship. Why was that? Most of them were escorted.
Well, in this particular instance, in many instances, they sent ships out that were fast. I mean, this was a fast ship, and they felt that if a ship were fast enough, why, it didn't have to go in a squadron convoy. And I guess, as I say, many a day we would just go in circles there, because evidently they would have been wired the fact that there were submarines ahead or something like that. And they always use a zigzag course. But it was a fast ship, and it had been a luxury ship. That was the reason that it was unescorted.
Did you see any enemy? Any planes, ships?
No.
Nothing.
No, nothing.
How'd you like traveling on the sea? Did that bother you?
I always enjoyed it. I really did. There was only one thing I didn't like about traveling on the ocean, and that was the fact that there's nothing to do except play poker or crap. And usually by the second day I was broke, and I never had a chance to really come off a millionaire. You know, actually, on those trips, it seemed that the money would become bunched before the end of the trip. And some of these individuals would have an awful lot of money. And they would actually hire other soldiers to protect them. You know, because, you know, how people are. And they could be quite vicious. But actually, so far as the ocean trip is concerned, I always enjoyed the ocean. And coming back from Europe, we came by the way of the North Atlantic, which was very, very rough. Going over, why the sea was very, very calm. But coming back, the North Atlantic is very rough. And actually, I don't believe there's another sensation like being in a rough ocean at either end of your ship, and especially the front end, where that bow would come up, come back down. What a sensation. And that's where you'd find me. I'd always seek out the either end. I never got seasick. Fortunately.
Let's go back to the time when you were in England, waiting to make those you know, the invasion of Norway.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to those, the buzz bomb again and the rockets. Did you ever go inspect any of the damage afterwards to see what it was like?
Well, the damage was evident. I mean, it was all over. I mean, a buzz bomb happened to hit at a particular time that you were there. However, maybe just a few days before, it hit right across the street. So it was there, and you could see it. And these buildings were gutted and mowed down. And
how constantly were these rockets and buzz bombs coming across?
Oh, you could hear maybe two or three every hour.
Every hour?
Yeah.
And this kept up the whole time?
For the most part, yes. And they had their own particular sound. I mean, it sounded... I imagine you might liken it to a lawnmower, actually. And then, of course, all of a sudden, you'd hear it miss, and then it would catch again, and then it would miss. It would catch once more, and then the next time it would miss, and you wouldn't hear it until you heard the explosion. And I don't know, have you ever seen one? It looked like a big, well, it was shaped like a big porpoise, you know, and then behind, at the back end, it seemed to have you've seen these microphones that they've used to, that's what it looked like, a big microphone on the back, but it was raised, and that was where the engine was, in the rear. And you could see them. You could see them.
Did you feel the shock wave from it going off somewhere by you?
Oh, yeah. Yes, you could feel it.
How was that? What did you feel like when that shock really hit you?
It would just be like any concussion. I mean, it would be like a blast, you might say. Yeah. And,
did they come over at night too?
At night?
Did you sleep through them? Did you get used to it to where it didn't bother you at night, or did you wake up every time one went off?
I got to the point where I'd sleep right through it. Because, as I say, they were coming over so frequently that if you were running for shelter, every time you heard one, why, you'd be running from here on in. You'd spend all your time in the shelter. And we had no trouble getting comfortable beds right on the top floor. So it was... But you got to the point where you got used to them, and developed a fatalistic type of attitude. Now, I don't know whether my attitude would be like that now or not. You know, at 20, your attitude would change. They're different. The English people, there was really something. I don't believe that people here at home realize, for the most part, those who weren't overseas and experienced this, I don't believe that they realize just what these people did go through. And by the same token, I don't believe they realize just how horrible it must have been for the German people to be bombed as they were. Anyone who's been in war realizes just how horrible it can be, and it's just a damn shame that here we were fighting to make the world safe for democracy, and here we are sweating out another one now. So are there any other questions you have there?
Sums it up. Is there anything else you would like to just mention in way of passing? Anything you can recall? Other experiences that you think might be worth recording here?
Honey. No, I can't think of any. Although I will mention this: I was pleasantly surprised to discover they had made a glider organization now, that is a World War II glider pilot, and I didn't know that they had organized them until back a few years ago, and I joined the organization, and they have frequent get together, reunions, but I have as yet been unable to attend one. Being a pharmacist and working as I do, my time is so tied up that I never get a chance to. They do have an organization. As I recall, there was one fellow who, as time went on, became more and more squeamish about being glider pilot, and when we were in Sicily, he decided that he was going to get out, evidently, one way or another. And started complaining to the doctor there that he was losing his appetite and he just couldn't eat. He had a blockage. Well, I ate dinner with him every day, and my God, he ate more than I could eat, and several other people together. But you know that he kept after that, and finally convinced the doctors that he was unable to eat, and he got transferred out of the gliders. And I understand that he went into some type of a ferrying service, you know, light plane. But he pursued it right to the end until he got out. But I don't know if he was losing his appetite. I'd hate to see him when he did have an appetite, you know?